What I want to talk about more today is sort of taking the discussion up a level and talking more about how we can try and anticipate and allow for our users who are more on the move, who are moving between different platforms and devices, and how we're going to design for that. Does that sound all right? Last chance. Nick's next door doing a great talk. Something about phones, I don't know. Some sort of development stuff. I don't know. I don't get it. Okay, so a little bit more about me. So here's some of my work I've done over the years, and this is sort of, I guess, trying to talk about different platforms that I've designed for, at least. So at the very left-hand end is, we're working at Cochlear, the people who make hearing implants, bionic hearing implants. We do a bunch of work at Cochlear. What we're working on at the moment is the next generation of the remote control that hearing implant recipients use to tune their hearing on a day-to-day basis. So the one you see on the left there is the previous one. I can't show you, unfortunately, the next one. But it's the device that people carry around during the day and make adjustments to their hearing. Something that you guys, or unless anyone here is, has got an implant, that most of us can't do. These guys are amazing. If in this room, and they want to best focus all their attention on me, they pull their remote control out and they go, focus. You can't do that. Well, I reckon 20 years from now, we'll all be signing up for the implants. I'm serious. So that's the smaller screen. I've done a lot of work for Windows Phone in Australia, Lonely Planet, Australia Post, Qantas, Rugby Union, a bunch of different apps for Windows Phone. In the middle is an app that we've been working on lately that I got permission to show that screen, but I can't tell you too much about it, but you can probably work out what it's for. And it's a tablet-based application for a retail environment. Just to show a little bit of television work, although it's a few years old now, some work for Austar in Australia on the online program guide. And also done a bit of work on Microsoft Surface. The one on the right there is a game we built for ANZ that they launched at the tennis last year, the Australian Open. So I've been lucky enough to work across, and I guess I should have had a screen for a traditional GUI with a mouse and a keyboard, right? I kind of forgot that. But I guess that's the point, right? Today we're going to be talking about how design and our design approach changes across all these different platforms. Maybe you should learn a little bit more about you guys. How many of you would call yourself a designer of any description? Cool. Some friends in the audience. And the rest, all the developers that I've just been insulting. Yeah? Right, okay. There'll be more of that. No, developers are important. They're the wind beneath my wings. All right, I'll stop. So, designing across multiple touch points and how we get our experiences out across different platforms. So who's designing or building for multiple platforms now? So maybe phone or tablet. Yeah? Who's designing for phone or smartphone? Anyone doing tablet work? Some of us will be, yep. Who's doing TV, large screen, wall-mounted UIs? Yeah, one of us, yeah. Cool. So Microsoft used to talk about three screens in a cloud. Now maybe they're talking about four screens in a cloud, or N screen. I've heard someone say N screens in a cloud in typical Microsoft fashion. The screens that they referred to traditionally was the phone, the PC, and the television, or the 10-foot interface. And I guess now we have to, or at least in 2 weeks from now, we have to worry about designing for tablets as well. And of course, if we're working outside the Microsoft ecosystem, then you then multiply that by the number of ecosystems. Then you add two non-screens. Because there are other touch points, there are other ways that people interact with their services and their service providers, right? And so I guess at the two extremes is the call center, the people we ring up on the phone, that's a user interface. And those user interfaces are designed, often not well, but designed nevertheless. And at the other end, is the shop, right? The storefront. And when, as we think about our lives as consumers, as we think about the relationship we have with our telco, our university, our bank, I'm going to talk about banks, the stores we shop from, what we can see happening and what will happen more and more is our relationship with those organisations is going to be smeared across all these different touch points. And it's only now that we're at the point where we have the technology and the capability and the infrastructure to start to try and align those experiences more effectively. So I want to step back a little bit and just talk about that whole idea of what we call a follow me experience. I've also heard it called a multi-headed experience, but basically this idea of not designing for an individual screen, but instead starting with designing an experience across screens. Because the user experience that you guys are creating for your software, your products, you know, really is the business that you're designing, or at least it's the business that you're expressing. Let me try and attack that again. What you as consumers and what your users and audience and customers consider to be your company is more and more encapsulated in the user experience of your website, of the phone service, of the shop front. If you were a bank, then you know, maybe when you thought about your brand, whatever that is, you'd think about you know, all sorts of things, including your mass media advertising, your TVCs, and your ads on the side of buses, and sort of all that sort of mass media advertising. That's what we traditionally think of as the brand. You think about the paper collateral, the statements that appear in the mail, and the brochures, and the forms, and stuff like that. And you might think about online banking and other sorts of interactive touch points as part of your brand. But you know, banking today, really, if you think about your exposure to your bank, just think about the relationship you have with your own personal bank, so much more of it is now expressed through your online banking or the various interactive elements, right? So the point I'm trying to make here, and the point you know, that we need to make to the people we work for, is that more and more, you know, the idea of the brand, the concept that a consumer has of the organisation that they interact with, is mediated through the website, the phone app, you know, all those interactive electronic software touch points. So the pressure's on us, really. It's a great opportunity, but we're going to see more and more attention focused on us and the software that we're making, because more and more that is the brand, that is the company in our users' eyes. And so when we talk about brand, we talk about less and less about a series of logos and colours and fonts, and we talk about a series of experience, a conversation that we have with a brand, a relationship that we build up with a brand over time and over a bunch of different touch points. So I've been working for Lonely Planet, as I said, and Lonely Planet thinks a lot about the various points at which it interacts with its customer base, whether it's through a book or through a website site or through a phone app, through forums, through traditional branding and advertising. Your relationship, whatever it is with Lonely Planet, is built up over those series of touch points. And the savvy organisations are designing those touch points to work together and to build a story. And that's why we start to talk about these follow me experiences. So you think once again about a bank. There's a bunch of different ways and places that I interact with my bank. And what the ideal relationship I have with my bank is one that follows me across these different touch points. So from the website to the phone app, and this is a bunch of work that ASB's been doing recently, which you guys will know better than me, trying to align all that branding, trying to align all those experiences across all their various touch points, such that my relationship with my bank becomes less about occasional deep interaction and more about a continuous shallow interaction. Does that make sense? And that's the relationship that banks want with you, right? They want to be a part of your life all the time, rather than just occasionally getting deeply involved, because that's how they're going to establish an ongoing relationship, right? And for the older people in the room, people my age, that sounds creepy. And for, you know, for all the Gen Ys and millennials in the room, as a rule, what we know is that they're up for that. They're up for an exchange of privacy in order to have a more meaningful and continuous relationship with the products and services that they that form part of their lives. And that's what we're designing for. So well, here's a slide to remind me to tell you what I'm talking about. I think I've probably covered that. what we want to talk about for the rest of this talk is how we design experiences across multiple platforms. So there's some obvious things, right, that you're immediately thinking about, you know, different screen resolutions, different standards for widgets and layouts and controls, different interaction styles, touch versus keyboard versus mouse versus voice, different designing for different abilities. So, you know, in a we might be talking about people's physical abilities, or might be just talking about the context in which they're in. If they're on a bus browsing our website on their phone, then it might not be appropriate time for us to be playing a lot of sounds, for example. They're using different technologies. Obviously, they may even have, you know, different fonts across their different browsers, and so, you know, it's pretty depressing. On the one hand, but do you know what? I'm not going to talk so much about this, right? I'm not going to talk so much about how big a button should be on different platforms or all those sorts of physical constraints of trying to design and deliver for different resolutions and different browsers and stuff like that. What I really want to talk about is the stuff in the less obvious column, and that is acknowledging that when we deliver our services to a different platform in a different context, then maybe the experience needs to be different. Or we at least need to understand how people will consume that experience in different environments. And a lot of the work we're doing for some of our clients at the moment is about understanding that sort of stuff. So let's just get the obvious and boring technical stuff out of the way. This is the most this is the most technical slide I have. So if you're here for technology, you can after this slide, you can leave. So if you're designing for HTML, then what we talk about is agent sniffing. So the idea of understanding what browser people are using, and then potentially serving up different CSS or different JavaScript, depending on the platform. There's a lot of talk about media queries at the moment, and IE9 now supports media queries, so we can now interrogate the browser and ask it how many pixels across are you, that sort of stuff. So is everyone, there's a link there, so I might as well follow it. So there's a little IE demo of media queries in action. Except I forgot to plug the browser in, so I might come back to that. Plug the browser in, plug the internet in. And we might serve up different CSS, for example, depending on the platform. So some work we're doing with one of our clients on the phone at the moment, they already have mobile site. What we're doing for Windows Phone is we're not detecting the agent. We know what the agent is because we're accessing the site from within a Windows Phone app. So we know what the agent is, we know it's IE, and what we're doing is we're swapping the CSS live to give a more Windows Phone-y experience, but it's the exact same website that you'll see on your iPhone or on any other mobile browser, just with a different skin. If you're working in XAML, if you're working in Silverlight, then you're thinking about some of the smart layout tricks that we can use in XAML. Setting min widths on items so that they'll only resize down to a certain point before which things like wrap panels start to cut in and we start to rearrange elements. So, you know, just to put this in context, let's see if this guy's working now. You know, the classic thing that, you know, and the first and most obvious thing we need to do if we want to deliver one experience across two different a desktop and a mobile screen is just let me bring this over to you. Mouse cursor, there we go. This is actually an IE10 demo, and I'm running it in IE9, but you get it works all right. If I can get my mouse to behave, there we go. So this is using CSS media queries to query the page, ask it how wide it is, and then based on how wide the page is, you'll see the layout's changing. So it's adding and removing elements, and eventually it'll drop down to a single column format. There we go. So that's CSS media queries at work, and it's on the next slide. But the point I was going to make on the next slide is that just rearranging the deck chairs is the bare minimum that you're going to want to do in order to deliver an experience on a mobile browser. So who today is delivering a web specific web experience for phone versus desktop? Some of us, yeah? So you're doing this media queries or... Yeah, so don't worry, I won't ask you. Nod is all I'm going to ask you. Yeah, cool. Back on the XAML side of the room, what we might do if we're feeling really clever is we might swap in or adjust different styles and templates. So we might have a template for a list that is wider for a widescreen and taller and narrower for a narrow screen, for example. But I'm not going to get into the technology of how to do that. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm probably not the most techo guy around. Certainly on the HTML side, there's plenty of really good sites and articles out on the web about how to do media queries and using plugins like Modernizer and PhoneGap and all that sort of stuff. In the XAML world, that stuff is a little harder to come by, but there are people out there talking about how to do smart layout with your XAML. But like I said, just to saying, oh, well, we've got a smaller screen, let's take the elements on the screen and rearrange them somewhere is really just window dressing, is just rearranging the deck chairs from, many deck chairs to a single deck chair. And I really want to talk about this problem, from a higher level. So if you've seen some of my talks before, I talk about the four layers of experience design. Because often when we talk about user experience and when I'm asked to talk about design, what we mean is the visual design stuff, the presentation, the layout stuff, the stuff we talked about last year. But really, to create an experience, visual design is the last thing we do. Because the job of visual design is to communicate to our users all the good work we've done before the visual design. Because visual design isn't primarily about your branding. It isn't primarily about making your site or your page look nice, although both of those things are important. The most important thing the visual design of your page has to do is communicate to the reader how to use it, where they are, how to find their way around, what they can do, what they can't do. So experience design naturally starts a long time before that. And, roughly speaking, so that's the deck chairs down there in the visual design, but this is the order we work through when we're doing experience design. First, we need to understand the concept or the overall experience. What is the experience that we're trying to create? And that's not just a functional spec. That's not just these are the features we're trying to deliver. But this is where we start to talk about what's the best way to combine those features to create the impression that we want to create. And I'm thinking particularly of the consumer space where we're basically offering products and services to consumers who have a choice. If we're designing for users who have no choice, for line of business, internal apps, stuff like that, we're still worried about and think about what is that overall experience, but we have a very different approach to it. It's more about efficiency and data quality, stuff like that, rather than so much about satisfaction. So we start by understanding the concept, then we try to structure, we call it information design or information architecture, try to structure the content and the features Then we talked about interaction design, how people will actually work with and control and manipulate those features and that content before we worry about visual design. So over the next few slides, I'm going to break that down a bit and just talk about some of the aspects in those four layers. So starting with conceptual design or determining what the right experience is. If we're designing across multiple platforms or designing to deliver across multiple platforms, the first thing we need to think about is what's the right experience for each of those platforms. So here's our four canonical screens. And what we need to think about when we're designing for these contexts is, what is our user doing? Where are they? How are they constrained physically? What are they trying to achieve? What motivates them at that time? And you can, so the first thing you want to do is think about the context they're in, right? So if they're using the phone, maybe they're sitting on a bus. If they're using the TV, then maybe they're sitting on a couch in their lounge room. If they're using their PC, then they're sitting at a desk chair. And if they're using their tablet, well, they're probably sitting on the toilet or in bed. An awful lot of people seem to use their tablets in bed, which is, hey, I confess to that. Although I got in trouble when I brought the tablet to bed one night and my partner said, "What's she doing here?" So this is a really, okay, I'm being a bit flippant, but this is a really important point, right? The things that I'm willing to do and able to do in a bus are very different to the things that I'm willing to do and able to do sitting at my desk. At my desk, I've got more time, it's quieter, I can focus, and so I'm willing to do things that maybe involve more time or that involve more analytical and thinking and critical work, whereas on the phone, I either just want to be, and certainly on the toilet, I either just want to be amused entertained. I was going to say I'm snacking on the toilet, but that's probably mixing metaphors too much. On the couch, it's usually a very passive experience. On the train, I'm worried about multitasking. I might not have very much time. The phone could ring at any moment. And this is a really important point. I think when we're designing for applications on the phone, the one thing we have to remember is that the phone could ring because it's a phone. And so we need to design, I think I've got a slide coming up, but we need to design experiences and activities that are bite-sized and that can be left at any moment. So people will tend not to commit to complicated stuff on the phone. They're not going to fill out their home loan application on the phone. They'll do that at their desk at home. But they might browse for credit cards on the phone. But once again, they won't apply for that credit card. So those are the sorts of things we're thinking about. So I was talking about chairs. We can also talk about, a lot of people talk about the posture, right? When you're using a phone, you're wandering around. When you're using your tablet, you may be sort of hunched over, sort of being more attentive. On your PC, you're sort of leaning forward and you're actively interacting with it. And the TV, you're laid back on the couch maybe. And you can see how I'd be motivated and willing to do different things in different situations. So the question is, what are you going to do about that? Do you rearrange the features? Let's use the bank example again. You know, you're a bank site, you're a bank, you've got a bunch of different services that you can deliver through your website or whatever. What are you going to do with your phone experience? Are you going to take all the same content and features and rearrange them in some way to make them work better on a phone, or you're actually going to curate them? In other words, you're going to decide which services to offer in different situations. And there are really two options there. You might say, okay, I see that you're on a phone or a tablet. I'm going to present, of all the things, all the features and functions that I could present you, these are the ones that I think you're probably most interested in. I'm going to sort of rearrange my information architecture and present those first. Or you might say, well, because you're on a phone, I don't even want to offer you this, you know, this feature, so I'm going to offer you a cut-down version. Now, you might be doing that for pragmatic reasons, but you might also be doing that for deliberate experience reasons. And one trick that that you can use is, if you're building native apps, is to really leverage that gap between your native application and your website, whether it's a mobile website or not. So we've seen various companies, I don't mean to use TSB as an example of this, I just was looking for an example of a Kiwi bank that uses a mobile website which has a different experience. And of course then I got there and I couldn't log in. Sorry, the point I'm trying to make here is that you might, if you're delivering a native app for the phone, you might choose four or five key features, deliver those natively, and then what you might do is fall back to the website to allow the users to continue the experience if they want to, and browse the full offering of your features. Interestingly, from an experience point of view, you can take advantage of that, and because that, if you signal that transition from your app to your website, you're kind of giving yourself permission to degrade the experience somewhat. Because if you signal that in advance, the users understand, okay, I was in the optimized experience, now I'm in the not so optimal experience. Oftentimes when we design native apps, we try to hide the fact that a lot of it might be delivered through a browser, and that's awesome too if you can get away with it. But it's just interesting, this idea that you might be able to stage your experience by having some native stuff, maybe some phone-specific browser stuff, and then a fallback to something that's more of a generic web experience, and signaling those things to users. So for example, more bank examples. On the phone, I might be happy to watch a short video about banking products, about selecting a credit card, or about buying a house, something like that. On a tablet where I can be more interactive and where I've got more space, more screen real estate, maybe that's the right place for me to do some sort of simulator or product comparison, where I can be a little bit more interactive, a little bit more choose your own adventure. You see the difference there? The phone experience is more passive. I make a single choice and then I just sit and watch. I'm much less engaged. Actively engaged. In the tablet, maybe I'm willing and I'm committed to making being more active. And then, of course, as I was saying before, it's probably back at my PC at home, sitting at my desk, that I'm actually going to fill out a loan application or fill out a credit card application. So in an ideal world, we would be delivering different experiences for the different platforms. So it's worth saying now, for those of you who are starting to worry, that I don't suggest for a moment is that we can continue to say, right, here is our iPhone offering, here is our Android offering, here is our Windows Phone 7 offering, here's our generic mobile browser offering, here's our Wii, PlayStation and Xbox offering, here's our browser offering, and on and on it goes. Right now, when we talk to a lot of our customers, they're saying, right, we want a website and an iPhone app. And that's their strategy. And at the end of the day, they need and you need to make a decision about how much money you're going to spend on and how well you're going to support the broad base of your customers. And the general approach is the website is the fallback, the lowest common denominator experience, and then we pick and choose from there specific sort of optimized or enhanced experiences that we want to deliver to particular platforms. Makes sense, but you're on a hide to nothing, right? Because this web thing is not going away. I've been hoping, but I think the horse has bolted. And we're just going to get, as much as we kid ourselves that we're going to get more consistency and between browsers and platforms, that's not going to happen anytime soon. And so you just really need to, this is actually, I've kind of gotten onto a point I was going to make at the end, but you need to be thinking about whether it's sustainable to have specific experiences for specific platforms, or whether you need to have a graceful experience that will adapt itself to different platforms, or a combination of the two. And speaking of link between them, you know, it may be that you have a you're thinking about what's best for the phone, what's best for the tablet, and what's best for the PC. But obviously, as I was saying before, because of these follow me experiences, we want to be thinking about how people are moving from between those things. So if I browsed for a credit card on my phone, and then I run a product comparison later, and then I fill out an application yet later on my website, and then I ring up the call center a week later because I want to know what's happening to my credit card. Ideally, that should be a seamless experience. Not easy to do organizationally. Often, you know, when you're working with an organization like a bank, those different parts of the business have, you know, their own specific agendas. But I guess architecturally, we're more able to think about this sort of stuff because more and more we have these service-oriented, backends that can deliver, you know, the same functionality and the same information to different endpoints more easily. And then I came across what I thought was a great local example of designing specifically for a platform. Has anyone seen this Westpac Impulse Saver from Westpac New Zealand? This is awesome. So the idea is, as I understand it, that it's an app you install on your iPhone, and it's got a big save button. You pick how much with the denomination you want to save, and then basically every once in a while you open up the app and you press the save button, and it transfers $20 from your normal everyday account through to your investment account. Awesome idea, and an awesome experience specifically for a particular platform, right? So a great example of how you can deliver just a small piece of functionality targeted at a particular platform. Great work. Now, a little bit more about tablets. And here's the thing about tablets. We don't quite know what they're for yet. So coming back to my food metaphor, I'm not the only one to use this food metaphor. You know, is it for snacking? Is it for foraging and searching? Is it for passive sitting back and consuming stuff? Is it actually for leaning forward and creating stuff? Is it somewhere in between? If we look at the main tablet ecosystems that are out there, which is mainly we're talking about iPad. Let's face it. It's very confusing, and I don't think even Apple really knew what was going to happen. I think they took a punt with the iWork. Or with the productivity apps on the tablet, but I think we're mainly seeing that people aren't really bothering to create a PowerPoint presentation or write any kind of, sorry, I shouldn't have said PowerPoint, keynote presentation, or any kind of decent document on their iPad yet. It's more about consuming and snacking, right? But having said that, you know, that's not what people want, clearly, right? Because what people love about their tablets is, well, all these things, right? It's light, it turns on instantly, it requires almost no maintenance, it might be more affordable than a proper PC, and it's easier to use by virtue of the fact that there are less things that I can do, quite apart from the design of any individual application. And so you get styluses, and I was in the speaker room just before, and Malcolm Sheridan's got a Bluetooth keyboard for his iPad, and people are trying to make them into input devices. Because of all these things that made them good consumption devices also make them good input devices. And so, you know, what's the Windows story here? I think what is going to be very interesting when we see in a couple of weeks' time and beyond what Microsoft's approach with Windows 8 is going to be is I think we're going to see a very interesting differentiator between Windows 8 on the tablet and iPad and Android on the tablet, because I hope the guys, and this is just Shane's opinion, right? This is nothing official here. I hope that those guys understand the power of creation and the fact that they're not doing what the other platforms have done. So the other platforms have taken their phone platform and made it into a tablet platform. And everyone was saying, well, Microsoft, you know, you should do the same thing, right? And they've apparently they've held out. And I think they've done the right thing. Because if they can, if in the 2 years or whatever it is since iPad's launched, if the hardware has caught up sufficiently and Windows 8 has come to the party sufficiently, we might have an awesome creation device with Windows 8 on the tablet. And we might start to see, keep an eye out for this, a very different pattern of use for Windows 8 tablets compared to iPad and Android tablets. certainly something that I'm going to be interested in looking out for. So those are my few slides about pointing out that the actual experience, the first thing you need to ask yourself is, do you want to deliver the same experience for your different platforms, or how do you need to tweak or adjust your experience for different platforms? Let's get a little bit more down and dirty and talk more about the actual structure, the information design. So if we think about big screens versus small screens, when I think about information architecture, what I mostly immediately start to think about is navigation. Because here's the thing, right? Looking at the world through your phone screen is like looking at your world through a toilet roll holder, right? You just get to see a little window on the world and you don't see the bigger context. So when I think about... the problem for that, the challenge for that is that when we design for a large screen website, say, we spend, if you measure it, we spend a lot of our pixels on navigation and orientation. Where am I? Where can I go now? When we start to design for smaller and smaller screens, we need to strip a lot of that context out because we just don't have the pixels for it, but also because we're designing a different style of experience, a more passive, a more browsy experience, we don't really want to present that first level navigation with seven options and all those footers with terms and conditions and contact us and all that sort of stuff. The stuff that really doesn't sit well with a more passive, a more browsy, a more snacky type experience. So one of the first things that goes as we design for smaller screens is all the nav and all the orientation and all the contextualization. Interestingly enough, if we're lucky and we're designing, I shouldn't say lucky, but if we happen to be designing a native app, we actually are better off in this respect because we can control the path that people have taken to get to our page. This is something, if you're moving from web design to designing a native phone app, something to bear in mind. When we design for the web, we pretty much have to assume that we can't predict how people got to any one page. So pretty much every page in our website has to orient the user as if it's the first page they've ever seen from our site. So it needs branding and it needs all that legalese and it needs the whole navigation, it needs context, it needs the breadcrumbs, it needs all that stuff so that if I land at this page, I can look around me and say, oh, okay, I'm on this page of this site, which is part of this section and is related to other sections in the following ways. If I'm using a phone app, by and large, I can predict the path that people have followed because it's more a case of you arrived at the home page, you made a choice from that, and you've drilled down some sort of hierarchy to get to this page. And on a typical phone application, there's only one path to that page. Now with Mango, that gets a little bit messy because it's awesome, but Mango allows us to sort of bookmark individual pages inside the application and pin them to the start screen if you guys let the user do that. So if you do that, you might need to think more about it. With the work we're doing at Qantas at the moment, for example, if you go into the top of the Qantas application, you can see your list of flight bookings. But what you can do is you can press and hold on any one flight and pin that flight to your start screen. If you want to see there was a demo of this at MIX earlier in the year in Vegas in the day two keynote. You can pin an individual flight to the start screen of the phone. So that means that we have to assume two paths into that flight, and it means that we have to work a little bit harder to contextualize the flight. It's not too hard because the flight details pretty much do the job of contextualizing what is it I'm looking at right now. Bouncing around on this slide a little bit, one of the things that we might need to ask ourselves is, do we have to eschew the orientation and the navigation, or do we rearrange it to move it? And I've got a slide coming up about that. And in terms of the structure of the information and features on the site, on a PC, or more to the point, on a large screen, then I'm more willing to and more able to multitask. So I can do more comparison stuff. I can put stuff up side by side. I can open three windows inside the one website. Obviously, when I'm working on my phone, I'm not going to do those sorts of things. And so we might need to think about what activities are best presented for the phone versus for the PC and steer people appropriately. Which brings me to browsing versus searching. We usually divide users up into three types, actually, though the third type is not so important today, browsers, searchers, and collectors. So browsers are people who've arrived at your site and are not sure what they're looking for, and so they're looking for cues from you about what have you got, what should I be interested in. Searchers, on the other hand, have arrived at your site with a particular need. You know, they're specifically looking for something, they possibly know what it's called, and they're looking for cues that say, this is the way to find that thing. And just for completeness, collectors are people who've arrived at your site and need to go through it rigorously, sort of from end to end, and make sure that they've covered off everything. Browsers and searchers are the ones we're most worried about. And when you think about our different postures of use on mobile devices versus desktop devices, you can see how, by and large, you can divide them up along the same categories. People at the desktop are more likely to be searching in the sense that they've got specific tasks that they want to achieve. People who are browsing on the toilet or in the bus are more likely to be a bit more casual about it, possibly not have specific tasks they want to achieve. And we need to ask ourselves, one of the first things we ask ourselves, is this app or is this part of the app more about searching or more about browsing, and therefore what sorts of cues and tips do we need to present on the screen to support those two different behaviours. What I really love about Windows Phone is that the designers of the experience acknowledge that. And so when you look at the typography, when you look at the visuals, when you look at specific controls like the panorama, you can see that they're acknowledging the fact that the phone is a browsing platform mostly. It's the platform that you'll snack on information, you'll quickly check someone's status, you'll browse for news, you'll browse for sports results, you'll browse for the weather. Unlike the iPhone, for example, I think that the Microsoft guys have done a great job of acknowledging that and setting up a visual language that says we are all about browsing. What you guys need to be careful if you're thinking about the native apps for Windows Phone is if you've got more of a searchy app, you just need to be a little bit more critical of the classic panorama, some of the classic layout of a Windows Phone app. Because you can make a perfectly good searchy Windows Phone app, but you just need to think about what's the right way to present that and don't necessarily... A panorama that has, a search box and not much else doesn't make a lot of sense. I'm probably an obvious, too obvious an example. But a searching app is different to a browsing app. So when we're structuring tasks, when we're thinking about the sequence of activities to deliver across the phone, we want to think about tasks that are safe to interrupt, that are not just short, but are obviously short. Because when you think about it, a user needs to commit to an activity. They want to reassure themselves that it's not going to take very long and that it's okay if they get interrupted. And that's sort of jumping to the bottom of the slide. That's why I talk about building trust in advance. You need to signal to users that the process of buying a ticket through the phone site, buying a concert ticket, won't take very long or can be interrupted and returned to. Because like I said, the phone could ring or you might lose connectivity. If we don't reassure people that it's safe to start these activities, then instead they're going to tend to avoid them and wait till they get back at their desktop, and so they've had a less satisfying experience. All right, so that was my few slides about information design. Let's drill in a little bit further and talk specifically about interaction design and visuals, and then we'll be almost done. So some obvious stuff, which once again, this could be a talk onto its own and I'm not going to harp on it. But obviously if you're designing for touch, then there are some things to consider. And they are kind of obvious, right? You need bigger targets. You need to think about the positioning of your labels so that when someone's got their hand hovering over the screen, they can still see the label. You know, you, normally we put the label above the control, for example. You need to think about the positioning of controls. We tend to move controls to the bottom of the screen for touch screens so that your hand's not getting in the way, and also so that you don't have to lift your arm and move it around so much. But the really important thing about designing for touch or for mobile platforms is this emphasis on direct manipulation, what the Windows Phone team calls content over Chrome. So the classic example is scrolling, right? On the desktop, when we scroll, we use a scroll bar and we drag the scroll bar, and that manipulates the content onto the left of the scroll bar. On the phone and on tablets, we drag the content itself, and the scroll bar is no longer a control, it's now an indicator. So the little indicator up the side that happens when you're scrolling tells you where you are in the content, but you don't use it to actually scroll. So, like I said, this could be a talk unto itself, but you need to talk about, if we're designing for gestures, you need to ask yourself, how will people know what the appropriate gestures are? Can you leverage standards and conventions that people have seen before, or standards for your platform? Or do you need to somehow communicate to people, you know, how to manipulate your product? And we talked about organic response. This is really, really important. The reason these touch devices, these touch platforms work so well is they feel organic. Organic in the sense that the moment you touch it, you get a response as if it was a physical object in the real world. It jiggles or it depresses or whatever. The second you introduce any sort of latency, any sort of delay between action and reaction, then you break that magic. You break what we call the perceptual fusion. So once again, if you have been designing for the web, or if you have a site that's designed for a web where people are, firstly, their interaction is mediated through a mouse, and therefore the interaction is less visceral, you might be getting away with delays, or you might be making an action at one part of the screen and the response comes at another part of the screen, and you might be getting away with that. That sort of stuff won't wash as well on a mobile site. And so you might need to rethink the interaction style, therefore. The good news, I think, is that what we're going to find is that organic response, that direct manipulation, is going to find its way back up into the mainstream platforms, into the desktop and stuff like that. So it's, if you were starting from scratch, not that many of us have that luxury, you might design for the touch platform first and then think about how it scales up to the bigger screen. And in fact, when we come back to talking about specifically targeting different platforms, what a lot of the pundits are saying is that you should design for the small screen and for the touch platform first, and then what they call progressively enhance to other platforms. I don't think that's a general rule that we can all, you know, that we all should follow, but it's a good starting point to say design for a lowest common denominator first, and then enhance up for bigger screens and other forms of interaction, rather than taking your big website and trying to jam it down into a mobile site or a mobile product, for example. Okay. Then there's the actual specific standards and conventions of a particular platform. So in Windows Phone, for example, the back button has a particular behavior, if you've watched people using Windows Phone, people always struggle with the back button for the first few minutes because it's not an interaction that they're used to. But once they get the hang of it, they love it, to the point where people become quite dependent on the back button. Another thing I love about about Windows Phone, and Android has back buttons as well, right? Yeah? Yeah. I don't have an Android phone. People come to rely on that as their get-out-of-jail mechanism, right? And what's interesting is it makes them more confident to explore. It makes them more confident to drill into your application because that back button is always there. But what you guys need to do is not let them down, right? You need to live up to that expectation. I guess, and the other classic, you know, specific thing for Windows Phone is the panorama and the pivot, very specific types of interaction that you may, if you're delivering a native app, that you might need to think about how the navigation on a traditional, on your website or on a traditional desktop app needs to change to fit these paradigms. One of the classic things that we do is we think about where to place the content versus the navigation. As I said, on a smaller screen, we tend to strip away as much navigation as we can. But the other thing that you'll often find if you look at a website versus a mobile site is that they're flipped around, that the content comes first and the navigation comes later. And that's, you know, for two reasons. Firstly, because you're looking at the world through that toilet paper tube, you want to reassure them that they've come to the right place and that the content they want is here. Whereas on a larger screen, we put the navigation first, largely because we're trying to communicate an information hierarchy. So while people's on a large screen, while people's attention is focused on the actual content, the nav and the orientation around it is what they use to orient themselves. I've said that already. So maybe we can get away with moving that orientation to the end if we can predict how they've come to here, which is the point at the bottom of this slide. So those are my few points about interaction style, and then just a few points about visuals, and we're done. And as I said, the role of your visual design is to communicate all of that work you've just done appropriately. That's the most important thing to do. I guess the first constraint to bear in mind is that if you're designing a native application, then there are some platform styles, you know, around the widgets and the guidelines that you're going to need to consider. And our friends at Microsoft, you know, are pushing very hard the idea that your app should be very metro-y, because we're working with Microsoft on a lot of our apps. We feel that pressure probably more than most to make sure our apps are as metro-y as possible. Sometimes we could see how we might want to stray away from the metro guidelines for a specific reason. And there's always a trade-off, you know. It's about making your app feel like it belongs on the platform versus you know, an optimal experience that is divorced from the platform somewhat. So iPhone versus Windows Phone for Australian Rugby Union, we did the one on the left. A lot of the same features. Not all, they're not exactly feature for feature exactly right. But what we focused on Windows Phone is that browsing and snacking experience. So we made the thing, we opened the thing up much more. There's a lot more panning and sort of snacking, dropping in and dropping out again. There's a lot more teasing. There's less lists and more things that flip over and sort of tease you. Designing a more, so same functionality, but quite a different interaction style, as well as a very different presentation style as well. Just important to think about contrast when you're designing for mobile. People are using that application out in daylight, so you might need to bump up your contrast. Branding. So the other thing about having less pixels is there's less room for your logo. But if you believed the point that I made at the start of this talk, branding is not so much about your colours and your fonts and your logos, so much as the experience and the attitude. And certainly when you're trying to build these applications that you want to become a part of people's day-to-day lives, then getting that across is much more about, as I say, the attitude, the terminology, your style, than it is about your logo. So this is the Lonely Planet Top 10 Cities application that we did last year. Very little Lonely Planet branding, because at the end of the day, imagery and, you know, some other elements of the Lonely Planet brand, I mean, we have taken some of the typography from the Lonely Planet brand, that the style of that stripe across the top is part of their visual language. But what we're relying on is the use of photography and the copy, which I haven't shown here, to get across the Lonely Planet brand. And that works for them as well as it does for us designing for a small screen. Okay, I need to just fast forward through a couple of slides. So I might I might just move fairly quickly through this. This is this question of whether you're going to restyle. I kind of covered this anyway. This is Australia Post, a similar sort of story, right? We presented the same functionality for Windows Phone with a very different attitude than the iPhone app. And we restyled and rebranded to suit the platform. So that was the stuff about visuals. By my calculation, I've got just a minute left, so I'm going to have to move a little quickly. Some things, and these slides are up, so if I go quickly through these last few slides, you can check them out. Some things never change, right? It's still about understanding the user, who they are, what they're trying to achieve, and how they're most likely to go about it in their context that will help you to design the best solution. I guess the key is to bridge the experience across platforms. And I haven't really talked about this, but things that allow an experience to move across platforms and continue across platforms are going to be the keys to this. Emailing a link so that I can continue the experience back home. Saving a half-finished application up into the cloud. When I move to a different platform, possibly seeing what I've been doing recently and customizing for that so that my experience moves across those platforms. One thing I'd encourage you guys to quickly have a look at is what Flickr have done. They have a phone application. They also have a tablet application as well as, of course, the website. And you can see how they've basically the same functionality, browsing photos. The posture is quite different across the different platforms. The most passive posture on the phone, so it's much more about just consumey, browsy, and much more social. On the tablet, it's still very consumey and browsy. There's a little bit of upload. Whereas on the website, the experience is much more workaday. It feels like you've got more work to do. You need to upload and you need to tag, you need to browse and search and sort and filter. And that's awesome and appropriate. But you can see how they've targeted the experience of the different platforms. So you're probably depressed. You're probably thinking that I haven't helped very much today. Because at the end of the day, there is no magic bullet that will tell you how to design one experience for multiple platforms. And if it was just up to me and it was up to making optimal experiences, then I would love to be able to deliver a custom experience for every platform. The reality is that we're not going to be able to do that, and it's really up to you guys to find the right balance. And it's going to come down to priorities. It's going to come down to obviously budget and return on investment. And so you need to ask yourself, where are my customers? What's the journey that I want them to go on, or what's the journey that I want to optimize them for? And how am I going to gracefully degrade the journeys that I'm not supporting so well? So how am I going to hand them off to my website, for example, if that's the most appropriate thing to do? So there was a couple of summary slides that I'm going to skip. And I just want to say at the end of the day, you want to be realistic. You want to set your priorities and then try to be authentic on every platform. I think that a dangerous thing to do is to offer an experience that doesn't feel right for the platform. And in many cases, you're possibly better off stripping back the experience to something that feels authentic and genuine, even if limited, for that platform, than trying to be all things to all people. So that's me. I just quickly want to put up the credits for some of the imagery I stole. We're out of time, but I'll be hanging around if anyone wants to grab me after the session. Thanks, everyone, for sticking it out. Before you break into rapturous applause, I'll be back this afternoon in the same room. We're going to talk about prototyping and how to use user experience prototypes, not just for designing user experience, but also how to use prototyping through the entire project lifecycle to get team cohesion and stakeholder communication and stuff like that. So prototyping after lunch. Thanks, everyone. You may now applause.